per hour and locally heavy rainfall could occur as well. That's 50-50 chance of that. Tonight's low 65. A nice day right now. Sunshine and 71 degrees in both Racine and Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Friday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I am profoundly excited about today's morning show interview because it concerns the amazing story of an amazing athlete. His name, Jim Thorpe. I suspect many of you know the name Jim Thorpe and know something about his story, his life, which included brief moments of tremendous triumph and also years of tremendous frustration. And it is the story, of course, that in a sense is a clear reflection of the experience of so many Native Americans. But Jim Thorpe's story, while sharing much in common with the overall story of Native Americans, is a unique story unlike any other. And it's a story told marvelously well in a new book called Path Lit by Lightning, The Life of Jim Thorpe. The author, David Marinus, is associate editor at The Washington Post and distinguished visiting professor at Vanderbilt University, twice a Pulitzer Prize winner for journalism, and the author of a good dozen books, including a book that I suspect some of you have read called When Pride Still Mattered, A Life of Vince Lombardi, a well-known book here in Packer country. But David Marinus has written about a host of other fascinating people and topics and has done an incredible job of telling this complex story of Jim Thorpe. The book is published by Simon & Schuster. David Marinus, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you, Gregory. My pleasure to be with you.
I'm so glad to be talking with you. I wanted to mention briefly that my introduction to Jim Thorpe was in something called Childcraft, which was a set of children's encyclopedias, the kind of the children's version of World Book Encyclopedia. And in one of the volumes devoted to notable people, maybe notable Americans, I forget, there was a chapter devoted to Jim Thorpe. And the specific story told is of the memorable football game in which he actually ended up facing off against future U.S. President Dwight D. Eisenhower. And it's a story rather fancifully told, thick with fiction, although the two of them, as you tell us in the book, really did meet in a football game. But it just underscores the fact that for so many of us, if we know anything about Jim Thorpe, chances are that what we know of him is not entirely based in the factual or historical record. And one of the interesting things you say in your book is that at least some of the blame for that, although not all of it, can be laid at the feet of Jim Thorpe himself, who you call at one point an unreliable narrator of his own career. Can you just talk for a moment about how challenging it was for you in crafting this book to sort out fact from fiction and history from legend when it comes to somebody like Jim Thorpe, who was in so many ways a larger-than-life figure in which so much myth was built up and much of that constructed by Jim Thorpe himself? What a challenge did this represent for you?
Well, you know, Gregory, it's interesting that you said you learned about him as a young person, because when I tell when I was telling people I was writing a book about Jim Thorpe, almost everybody would say, oh, I read about him in fourth grade. So, you know, that's sort of the common experience. And I think, honestly, I don't put as much blame on Jim Thorpe in terms of that mythology as you might think. I think all of us, sort of, especially large figures, they're shrouded in myth, some of their own making, much of it of the making of the people who tell the stories about them. So, you know, Jim Thorpe's own myth-making was relatively minor, but it was interesting to me. You know, he told the story of how he once hit three home runs into three different states, you know, in one game. He was playing in Texarkana, and he would tell the story of how he hit home runs into Arkansas, Texas, and Oklahoma in one game, which is a geographic impossibility. but he did hit three home runs in that game. So, you know, there's sort of why exaggerate the myth? You know, I say that people who have majestic talents are often made into something superhuman. And that was the case with Jim. And so, you know, what happened was that in his later life, people would tell these stories and Jim would go along with them and exaggerate them. But, you know, I talk about how I do a book and sort of the four legs of a table. And the first leg is to go there to the places of someone's life. The second is to interview as many people as I can. The third is to get as many documents as I can. And the fourth one, which gets to this, is to look for what's not there, to try to break through the mythology and find the real story. And that's a challenge for every book I've done. And I do it primarily through finding as many contemporaneous accounts as I can and as much archival primary research as possible to find out what really happened. So in another case, the story that the game you mentioned against Army, where it was said that Thorpe ran back a kickoff for a touchdown and it was called back because of a penalty, and then he did it again.
In the very next play.
On the very next play. It's a great story, but it's not true. And I looked at every newspaper account of that game, and none of them tell of that story. So he did return a punt for a touchdown that was called back. But that's, you know, but it didn't happen twice. And how that story developed is it's part of the legend of the mythology of some great human beings. I mean, with Lombardi, I had to cut through legends where sort of every possible motivational saying in history was attributed to Vince Lombardi, whether it was true or not. Just like Yogi Berra gets attributed every comic statement in sports. It's just part of what I do is to try to figure out what really happened as opposed to what's common and said.
We're speaking with Dave Marinus, talking about his book, Path Lit by Lightning, The Life of Jim Thorpe. And I think I should let you explain that beautiful title, Path Lit by Lightning.
Yes. Jim Thorpe was born in 1887 along the banks of the North Canadian River in what was then Indian Territory of what would become Oklahoma. And on the evening before he and his, by the way, he was a twin. His twin was named Charlie, who sadly died at age 9. But in any case, on the evening that they were born, there was a thunderstorm, and he was given the Sac and Fox name. He was from the Sac and Fox Nation of Wet'suwet'en, which can be translated poetically into Path Lit by Lightning. And so that, as soon as I saw that, I said, that's the title of my book. It just sort of illuminates his life.
Hmm. One of the things that I appreciate about your book is that although there is plenty that is so fascinating simply in the life of Jim Thorpe himself, you don't limit yourself to just the man Jim Thorpe, but also kind of the overall landscape in which, for instance, he grew up and attained adulthood and through his struggles and so on. And the story of Jim Thorpe is both a singular story of one unique man, but also of what it meant to be a Native American in the late 19th and early 20th century. One of the things you tell us in one of the early chapters devoted to his childhood is how American Indian tribes in this era were divided by the U.S. government into two categories, wild or civilized. Could we just take a moment to kind of talk about that and what you think this interesting fact has to say about the way in which, in general, Native Americans were viewed at this time?
I'm glad you asked that question because, you know, when I write this type of biography, I'm looking for two things. The first is sort of just a great dramatic story, and the second is a way to illuminate American history and sociology through that, the person that I choose to write about. So, yes, I mean, in almost every aspect of Jim Thorpe's life from 1887 to his death in 1953, you can see the elements of how the United States government and the powers that be, white society, shaped Native American lives. The whole point of that defining between wild and civilized gets to the larger issue of what the government was trying to do with Native Americans, which was, as I put it in the book, rid them of their Indianness. You know, civilized was a Native American who was thought to be acculturated and assimilated into white society. Wild was a Native American who was still trying to live in their own culture and religion and language. You know, it was that dehumanizing. Jim Thorpe, at age 16 and for the next, on and off for the next 10 years, was at the Carlisle Indian Industrial School in Pennsylvania, whose motto was kill the Indian, save the man, which gets right to that wild versus civilized instruction, where they wanted to get these students, often taken against their will of them and their parents, to this school and rid them of their language, their religion, their culture, cut their hair, dress them in the uniforms of the U.S. Cavalry, and make them as white as possible. That was literally the United States government's policy with Indians after the period of actual genocide, you know, the Indian Wars of the mid-19th century. After that, it was to try to take away their Indianness in other ways. Hmm.
You tell us early on, and correct me if I'm remembering this incorrectly, I believe by the age of 16, Jim Thorpe was an orphan.
Yes.
And he was the son of two, from what we can tell, very, very interesting people, including a father who had five wives and 18 children, and a mother with some gifts as well. At the age of 16, Jim Thorpe is an orphan, but you write, but long before that, he followed his own path between divided worlds, Indian and white. Explain what you mean by this path between divided worlds, Indian and white.
Well, at a fairly early age, he was sent to these Indian boarding schools, which he really did not like, and he ran away from them a few times, first to the Sac and Fox School in Oklahoma, then to the Haskell Institute in Lawrence, Kansas, and finally to the Carlisle Indian Industrial School in Pennsylvania. And all of them were trying to sort of inculcate him into a white way of life. Jim Thorpe, throughout his life, loved, you know, the life of the Native American, of living on the land and hunting and fishing. He said, he was great at many sports, but he said his favorite was hunting and fishing. And so, in so many ways, he was caught between those two worlds, as were thousands and thousands of young Native Americans in that era. Hmm.
You've already touched on this Carlisle Indian Industrial School, which Jim Thorpe attended. And although in so many respects, it was built on attitudes that now most of us would find completely repugnant. Oddly enough, Jim Thorpe, later in his life, would look back on those years at Carlisle as the happiest years of his life. You paint a very vivid picture of what this school was like, and this process of assimilation that that was present from the moment they would step onto that campus. Explain what kind of an education was given to these young people, and in particular, this intriguing split of the typical day of 4 hours of this and 4 hours of this and 4 hours of this. It's kind of extraordinary to think about.
Yeah, I mean, the Carlisle Indian Industrial School in athletics competed against the great colleges of that era, against Yale and Penn and Princeton and Harvard and Army and Syracuse, but it was not a college. It was an industrial school that had students ranging in age from age 10 or 12 to 25, all of them there learning different trades and getting some sort of liberal arts education and business school education. And to get back to your original point, the reason Jim Thorpe thought it was among the best periods of his life is because it was his most successful period. You know, as the All-American football player, as the winner of the gold medals in Stockholm, all of that happened during the period when he was at Carlisle. He also met his first wife there. And many of the Native Americans, not just the successful athletes, but many others, figured out how to survive there. As much as the effort was to completely acculturate and assimilate them and rid them of their heritage, the Native American students, many of them figured out how to deal with that. Not all of them did, and many of them actually died there. There's a haunting Indian student cemetery that still exists on that land, which is now part of the Army War College, with 186 gravestones. It's very haunting to go look at that. But in any case, Thorpe figured out how to survive. He was a terrific athlete. He was the most successful athlete of that era at the Carlisle School. So one can understand sort of the contradictions of a place that is, in one sense, dehumanizing and also offering opportunities to people in other ways. And that was the case with that school.
I remember that portion in the book when you talk about how the death toll among the students was 1 in 5. That is 1 in 5, and perhaps it was even worse than that, but at least 1 in 5 Carlisle students ultimately perished before they managed to graduate. So that's certainly a disturbing trend. Something else disturbing about what you describe in terms of Carlisle was that one of the goals of Carlisle was to keep these students from going back to their reservations. I mean, in a sense, they wanted to try to help kind of achieve a break between these students and where they had come from. Remembering that correctly?
Yes, you do. The founder of the school, Richard Henry Pratt, who had the motto, "Kill the Indian, Save the Man," essentially, said that he would consider it a failure if any of his students went back to the reservations. That's a part of the entire effort to assimilate them into white society and break up the Indian culture. So it was done in two ways. The one way was through those boarding schools. The other way was literally by taking away the communal land of reservations. Thorpe was born in 1887, the year of what was known as the Dawes Act, which essentially took much of the land of Native Americans and made them private property owners with smaller parcels as opposed to the larger communal property. I mean, the entire Oklahoma land rush, which is fairly well known in American history, was a land rush by white settlers going into what was formerly Indian territory, their land. So the whole aspect of the way that the American government dealt with Native Americans was to assimilate them through boarding schools and through land grabs.
And one of the interesting policies also there was something that you call the outing system, where students would be kind of farmed out to various white homesteads near to Carlisle, in a sense, to experience life and to labor, sometimes mercilessly, endlessly laboring on the farmsteads of whites in and around that area. Another way to, in a sense, introduce them to another world that the folks at Carlisle hoped these students would ultimately gravitate towards. But we need to talk about Jim Thorpe, the athlete, and his extraordinary exploits, particularly on the football field. And one of the key figures there is someone by the name of Pop Warner. Explain the important role that Pop Warner played in Jim Thorpe's life and in his early athletic career.
Pop Warner is one of the icons of American college football, and in fact, youth football leagues are called the Pop Warner leagues even today. He was the inventive, innovative coach of the Carlisle Indian School, both football during the era of Jim Thorpe. He's the one who sort of found Jim Thorpe, recruited him onto the track and football teams in 1907. And they really rose together to fame, both on the football field and track. Pop is the coach, and Jim is as his star player from 1907 on and off through 1912. So in many ways, Warner went on from Carlisle to be the coach at Pitt, where he had several undefeated seasons, and then at Stanford. And he became, a Hall of Fame coach. And he was a great coach, but he was also a flawed human being and a coward at the point of Jim Thorpe's major crisis, which I'll know you want to ask me about, when he lost his gold medals after the 1912 Olympics. Warner is a great disappointment during that period.
Right. That's a very, very sad chapter. I'd love to have you, in case any of our listeners have never heard it, one of the most famous stories to emerge from Carlisle, and I can't remember, I think it's at least mostly true, or at least there's a grain of truth in the story of Jim Thorpe and the way in which he initially demonstrated his track prowess there.
Yeah, I mean, I think, it gets told in different ways, but essentially he was not in 1907, the spring of 1907, he was not involved in Carlisle athletics yet, and the track team was practicing. Thorpe was coming off a job working at the school in the afternoon, saw a bunch of boys trying to jump over 6 feet in the high jump pit and not succeeding, and Thorpe, in his overalls, easily clears the 6-foot bar in the high jump. And Pop Warner heard about that, and the next day called him into his office and put him on the track team. And that was the beginning of their experience together and Thorpe's rise in athletics.
Hmm. We're speaking with David Maranis, and we're speaking with David Maranis, author of Path by Lightning, The Life of Jim Thorpe. It is while Jim Thorpe is at Carlisle that he leaves school for a time because he wants to play baseball and wants to make a little bit of money, at least playing, I don't know if we would call it professional baseball or semi-professional baseball. But at any rate, one of the things you tell us, and it's important for us to note this for what comes later, is that at this point in time, the lines between amateur and professional sports were blurring. Tell us more about those blurring lines between the amateur and professional worlds of sports, and particularly how that played out for young Jim Thorpe, the baseball player.
Yes, in the spring of 1909, he went down to North Carolina, to Rocky Mount, North Carolina, to play baseball in the Eastern Carolina League. In that period, hundreds of college athletes were spending their summers playing baseball for a little bit of money, $2 a day or $30 a month, perhaps. And most of them played under aliases. So, for instance, Dwight Eisenhower, who would later play against Jim in football when he was at Army, played in the Kansas State League under the name Wilson. There were so many aliases in the Eastern Carolina League that it was jokingly called the Pocahontas League because everybody was named John Smith. It was said there were more aliases in that league than there were aliases of gunmen in New York City. But Jim Thorpe played under the name Jim Thorpe. He never tried to hide it. He was recruited to play there by one of the close associates of Pop Warner, who brought in several of the players from the Carlisle Indian School to play in the league that year. So, yes, the lines were blurry, and they were even more blurry when you examine what happened to Jim when he lost his medals and who else was an amateur or a professional during that period.
In this chapter where you are talking about his Jim Thorpe playing, for instance, for the Rocky Mount Railroaders, one of the things you tell us that when you read about his exploits on this baseball team, one sees over and over again in press accounts the use of Indian stereotypes again and again and again. Just give us some sense of what we find if we uncover newspaper accounts of Jim Thorpe's baseball exploits from this period, the way in which those exploits were described.
Yeah, it wasn't just in baseball. I mean, when the Carlisle Indian football team would play, it was the same thing. It was just common during that period. You know, if Jim Thorpe was called the chief, every Native American athlete was basically called chief something or other. You know, if they won, they're playing, they'd be on the war path. They'd scalp. You know, all of those stereotypes of what Indians, of sort of the noble savage, were just commonplace in all of the accounts of Thorpe in that league and, you know, when he was at Carlisle playing football. I rarely found a story, you know, out of the hundreds and hundreds of newspaper articles that I examined, both in the baseball era and in football, where Thorpe or his Native American teammates weren't disparagingly described in those sort of stereotypical terms.
Hmm. Well, ultimately, Pop Warner desperately wanted Jim Thorpe back at Carlisle in order to resume his football playing there, but also so he would have a chance to train Jim Thorpe for the 1912 Olympics in Stockholm, Sweden. And so for as much as we might really feel dismay over a lot of things that Pop Warner said and did in relation to Jim Thorpe, it sounds like we have we have Pop Warner to thank for having kind of the vision that Jim Thorpe could potentially have a place in a significant place in the Olympic Games.
Yeah, I mean, there was an interesting sort of codependence between Thorpe and Pop Warner. I wanted him to come back to Carlisle partly because his football team was losing and he needed his star player back. But he did bring him back and they did get to the Olympics together and really that's where Jim Thorpe gained his fame. If he had not come back, we never would have heard of him. So, you know, he both as an All-American football player and as a gold medalist in the Olympics, all of that happened after he had played minor league baseball. Hmm. So, yes, I mean, it was Pop Warner who brought him back out of a mutual need. Hmm. So that's how that happened. But then after he came back and after he won the gold medals, when it was revealed in what was called a scoop, although it wasn't really because Thorpe's name had been in the papers in North Carolina for 2 years every day when he was playing baseball. Anyway, the scoop was that, yes, he was not an amateur but a professional because of that baseball. Pop Warner denied that he knew anything about it. He basically threw Jim under the bus and to save his own reputation. So very complicated, interesting relationship between those two men.
Right. And by the way, I love how you point out at one point, as Jim Thorpe returns to Carlisle to resume his football playing and to train for the Olympics, ironically, Jim Thorpe's lack of success in baseball probably led him to lasting fame. I mean, if he'd been just a little bit better at baseball, he probably never would have left the world of baseball, and we might not have ever even heard of Jim Thorpe. But instead, you know, the frustration, I mean, he was someone with great talent, but lacking some polish and certain skills, and that's one reason why he ultimately finds his way to the Stockholm Olympics as part of the U.S. Olympic team. He was not the only Native American on that team. So for all the dismay that we might feel about so many ways in which Native Americans, including Jim Thorpe, were treated, it's probably worth noting that that there was more than one Native American on that team in 1912.
His teammate, Louis Talanima, who was a long-distance runner, was also on that Olympic squad, as was a marathoner, Sock Alexis, from the Penobscot tribe in Maine. So, yes, there were three Native Americans on that Olympic team. One African-American, Howard Drew, a sprinter, who was probably the fastest man in the world, but sadly got injured during the heats. And getting back to the point about baseball, you're absolutely right. I mean, football was really not a professional sport then. I mean, there were professional leagues, but it was a secondary sport. You couldn't make much money in it. You couldn't make money in track. And Jim wanted to survive in a career in sports, and baseball was that opportunity. So, absolutely. If he had been a little bit better early on and risen through the minor leagues, he might never have gone back to Carlisle, and he might never have become the world-famous figure that he did.
I love the detail with which you describe the proceedings of the Stockholm Olympic Games, and there are all kinds of things that very different from the way the Olympics are played out now, including the fact that there was no Olympic Village and that basically the American team ended up just kind of staying on their boat in the harbor like a floating hotel. And another thing you tell us is that the Swedes found these Native Americans to be incredibly exotic. I think you write at one point, to the Swedes, few things seemed more exotic than an American Indian. Most had never seen one, but many had read about Crazy Horse and Sitting Bull and Geronimo and powwows and teepees and side saddle riding and bows and arrows and so on. And so Jim Thorpe, although he didn't go out of his way to attract attention, in fact, attracted tremendous attention from those in the Swedish public who, in a sense, came across him.
That's right. I mean, you know, even today when you go to Europe, there's a fascination among Europeans with the Native Americans because it's so different from anything that they knew about. So, yeah, Thorpe was, when he was training in Stockholm, he was approached by a group of young women who had heard that there was an Indian on the team, and they sort of were shocked that he didn't look like what they thought he would. You know, he wasn't wearing a headdress, and he didn't have war paint on, and all of that they assumed that an Indian would have to look like. So Jim said that just to play along with them, he gave out a loud war whoop and scared the heck out of these young women who ran away. And, you know, it sort of exemplified the way that expectations of what an Indian should be and would be that he dealt with throughout his life, where he both, you know, understood the game and played along with it at times, like he did there.
Jim Thorpe, of course, goes on to win 2 gold medals in the Stockholm Olympics. You tell us that was the last Olympic Games in which the gold medals were literally made of gold. And in the decathlon in particular, his victory is, from the looks of it, one of the most decisive in Olympic history. Just explain the extent to which Jim Thorpe outclassed the rest of the field in the decathlon.
You know, Gregory, it's hard to compare decathlons from different eras because the scoring system is different, and of course the records are different because of training and equipment and so many other things. But Thorpe dominated the field in a way that no decathlete has had before or since. He almost doubled the points of many of his competitors. He was good at all of the different events except for the pole vault, because he was so heavy and pole vaults in that era could break, and he was afraid he'd break the pole vault going over the, you know, going over the bar. But he was strong. He was excellent in the weights, the shot put and the hammer throw. He was fast, and he could jump. So he was such a great all around athlete that he won most of the events, or never finished lower than third in any of the 10 events.
And I think, if I remember correctly, you tell us that by that last event, whatever it was, the only way he could have possibly lost, that is, lost the decathlon, is if he withdrew. I mean, all he had to do was show up for that last event. And he was still going to be...
And one of the competitors on the team, on the American team, was none other than Avery Brundage, who would later go on to be the head of the U.S. Olympic Committee and of the International Olympic Committee. He was a decathlete, too. And Thorpe was so far ahead of Avery Brundage that Brundage quit after 8 events. He knew he couldn't compete anymore, which I find particularly telling, in that Brundage would later talk about how it wasn't how you performed, but that you were there and competing that mattered. And here, when he was clobbered, he dropped out himself.
Hmm.
But yes, Thorpe dominated the field.
And of course, he walks away with 2 gold medals from those Olympics. And there's that famous moment where he supposedly responds to the congratulations of the Swedish king with simply, "Thanks, king." And you have an interesting little passage in the book where you discuss whether or not that actually happened. By the way, you make reference to the fact that there is extensive film footage of the 1912 Stockholm Olympics. Does any of that footage include any moving images of Jim Thorpe himself competing?
There's one small image of him competing, but most of the images of Thorpe are of him getting the medals from the King of Sweden, sadly. So, you know, one of the difficulties in writing the book was to find images of Thorpe on the football field or on the track field. There are very, very few of those. So I had to rely on descriptions from newspapers and other sources on how he did it. But the documentary on those Olympics runs 2 hours, and it is totally fascinating to see it in real time.
So Jim Thorpe returns to Carlisle, a triumphant hero, and one of the most famous athletes in all the world. And, of course, it is sometime in 1913 that the story emerges that Jim Thorpe had earned money playing baseball. You discuss this extensively in your book, and we'll leave it to our listeners to explore that on their own. But one of the most crucial things I think we need to help people understand is it's not just the fact that he didn't make a lot of money playing baseball, and lots of people played baseball for money, and lots did it under aliases. So, I mean, there are all those matters. But there's also a really clear reason why those medals should never have been taken away from Jim Thorpe, and it has to do with the rules about when such a protest needed to be filed. Explain that inescapable reason why these medals should never have been taken away from Jim Thorpe, at least the way that they were.
Yeah, it's an interesting issue, and it's sort of a technicality, but the rules of the Olympics that year said that a challenge to someone's amateurism could only be in effect if it was filed within 30 days of the end of the Olympics. The story about Thorpe competing in the baseball minor leagues appeared 6 months after the Olympics. So it was too late. And the Swedes knew that. They said, once the Americans told them about what had happened, too late, sorry. But nonetheless, it proceeded through the International Olympic Committee, and his trophies were taken away, his medals and his records, but against the Olympics' own regulations.
Hmm. I find it telling that the gentleman who finished second to Jim Thorpe, who I think was a Swede, Hugo Wieslander, said Jim Thorpe was the winner, and he had no interest in receiving that gold medal that he thought justifiably belonged to Jim Thorpe. I mean, that says a lot when the guy who comes second refuses the gold medal that they want to give to him because of all this. You tell us Thorpe emerged from the ordeal toughened but not ashamed. The balance of your book goes on to talk about Jim Thorpe and all that he did in the wake of that, including some years of glory as an athlete, but years then after that in which things turn sadder because Jim Thorpe just is unable to quit. I mean, it's the athletic field is where he had enjoyed such tremendous success, and that it was a struggle for him to know where to go on from there. One of the things you tell us is that Jim Thorpe didn't just play games, but he was also someone who even tried to dabble in organizing, and he's even a key figure in the emergence of what we now call the National Football League. So there was more to Jim Thorpe than just his exploits as a player.
Yeah, he wanted to be a coach, and he was the player coach for the Canton Bulldogs and first the Ohio League and then the incipient National Football League, and also the coach for a wonderfully named team of all Native Americans called the Oorang Indians, which competed in the NFL for 2 years. But he never really got the opportunity after that he was looking for. And so he went from job to job. I think he lived in 20 states. And over the course of, after his athletic career was over, had jobs ranging from, greeter at various taverns to the head of youth athletics in Chicago to appearing as a extra in about 70 movies in Hollywood. That was one of the more interesting parts of his post-athletic career when he became the spokesman for Native Americans and around the studio industry, of whom there were about 200, trying to get them to get the jobs that were sometimes given to white actors in grease paint as opposed to real Indians in the Westerns, and also to get the movies to present Native Americans in less negative stereotypes.
Hmm. It's interesting, too, as you describe, before he goes to Hollywood, when he is still trying to scratch out a living playing professional baseball and professional football, you remind us that this is a time when it was a hard scrabble kind of existence. You write at one point, the worlds of pro baseball and football in this time were domains of great athletic feats and desperate personal lives. The men played in fear without financial security, their existence determined by fickle and often penny-pinching bosses. So Jim Thorpe by no means is alone in struggling to survive as a professional athlete in this time. It's just a world so different from the world of professional athletes today. But because he was Jim Thorpe and so famous, it's his story, in a sense, that lives on.
Yeah, I mean, he was being paid luxuriously when he made $300 a game in football. You know, today a great football player can get $240 million to sign a contract. So it's a totally different world. He never had that financial security. Baseball paid more than football, but not much. And, it was during Jim's time in baseball that the Black Sox scandal happened, where players threw games for the White Sox, and partly because their owner, Charles Comiskey, was such a tightwad and you know, as were many owners during that period, that players were scrambling around to get money and more vulnerable in that sense. So it was a hard scrabble existence for most athletes.
At one point you write, in describing this period, by this point we're talking about the mid-20s, Jim remained the itinerant athlete, still trying to earn a living as a migrant worker chasing the seasons, still on the road more than home. And by the way, I want to make sure that we mention briefly that a couple of the most dramatic moments in Jim Thorpe's athletic career happened right up the road in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, including a memorable football game in which he squared off against the legendary Paul Robeson.
Yeah, no, Milwaukee comes into the story several times. He played a full season for the Milwaukee Brewers minor league team, was their star player. The team was terrible, but he led the league in stolen bases and hit over 300. Then when he was playing for what I told you earlier about the Oorang Indians, they played the Milwaukee Badgers, and Thorpe was the star of the Oorang Indians, and the star of the Milwaukee Badgers was Paul Robeson, who went on to become the great singer, actor, and activist. And the Badgers won that game, and Robeson was the star. But I say in the book that of all the events that happened in Thorpe's life, I would have loved to have been a fly on the wall to see that.
No kidding. Absolutely. And, of course, your book goes on from there to describe those sad years when Jim Thorpe has all kinds of fame, but most of the time little or no money at all, trying to figure out what to do next, and from one exploit to another, such frustration, a little too trusting, maybe a little too generous. There is that drinking problem. There are all kinds of things that keep Jim Thorpe from achieving the lasting success and security that he so desperately wanted and frankly deserved. But ultimately, we get the sense from reading your book that you look on the life of Jim Thorpe as not ultimately a tragedy. I sense from your book that you have great admiration for his determination in the face of so many obstacles.
Yeah, you know, for the last 20 years of his life, as I was writing it, I was rooting for something better to happen to him. You know, and in that sense, I was almost tempted to think of it as a tragedy, and there were certainly tragic elements to it. But I came to realize that it was his perseverance that dominated the story, that he kept trying no matter what. And I saw that as a larger symbol of the experience of Native Americans in this country. You know, at one point, they were down to 250,000 Native Americans, and it was called the end of the trail, and the thought that the race would be extinguished by white dominance and manifest destiny and assimilation. But it didn't happen. The Native American culture persevered and is thriving today, and Jim Thorpe persevered as well.
And, of course, ultimately, his gold medals are returned to him, sadly, decades after his death. But one more wrong righted eventually.
And the records finally restored just last month in July, 110 years too late. But they were restored.
Yes. Well, that and much more is told in your fascinating book, Path Lit by Lightning, The Life of Jim Thorpe, surely to be regarded as the definitive account of the life of this fascinating man. The book published by Simon & Schuster, the author David Marinus. David Marinus, thank you so much for giving the world this important book, and thank you for being my guest on The Morning Show.
Well, thank you, Gregory, for letting me talk about it. It was a pleasure.
Monday on The Morning Show, you will hear my conversation with the Poets Laureate of both Kenosha and Racine. On Tuesday, Dr. Art Sear joins us for his monthly visit. And on Thursday next week, Dr. Thomas Carr, paleontologist from Carthage, talking about his latest dinosaur exhibition. Sunny and warm today with a high of 83 degrees. Partly cloudy tonight, but with a 50% chance of showers and thunderstorms. Some lightning and locally heavy, strong winds and heavy rainfall could occur. Overnight low of 65. Tomorrow, Saturday, an 80% chance of still more rain. And we could have some locally heavy rainfall with the storms. Tomorrow's high 78. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, NPR.